top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Did you know that he's still thinking of leaving?
So you did. You know everything, don't you? But he won't. Doesn't want to keep me here. Same way I kept you here. I'll never leave.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 383 of the Really Awful Movies podcast. Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker. Now, if this rhyme rings a bell, I mean, it should. It's from Rub-A-Dub, Three Men in a Tub. And talk about an oblique reference here. I mean, this is as indirect as you can get. Three Men in a Tub, I'm guessing. And this just dawned on me. It didn't occur to me right away. But this refers to the rather unique premise in this 1982 film of a love triangle between three men. And even to the extent that it wasn't actually the case, this is one of the foundations of an investigative detective's work into one of the murders in this film. So this is one of the gayer entries in the horror pantheon, the other being Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, although with that film, the homoeroticism was subtext, whereas this is all text. And this is an interesting beast because Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker, could easily be dismissed as one of your standard stalk and slash type films, because that's the appearance it gives off. You know, when it has the flashing knife blade in the poster art imagery, which conjures up the likes of your Prom Nights or many a giallo film that did that. But this is a slow burn film that has at its core an almost vulnerable male protagonist and not the standard final girl. So the vulnerability tables, if you will, are being turned with this one, and that makes for interesting viewing, that's for certain. So like a standard 80s film, this one has a prologue, and this is something that, well, the aforementioned Prom Night, you have this bullying scene and someone falling out a window, and of course a Hospital Massacre has a young kid who's rebuffed on Valentine's Day. And in the case of a prologue, typically, and there's just a litany of them, too many to name here, but it's typically used as an almost chronological justifier for an antagonist's psychopathic behavior later in life. And what you get here is young Billy Lynch being taken care of by a caregiver while his parents go on a road trip. And as their vehicle meanders through the California hills, they meet with this terrible accident. It almost reminds me of one of those wood log incline rides at the fair, county fair or something, where you get in the log and you go down and you splash. They're too closely following a lumber truck, and one of the I guess they get into an accident, and one of the trunks slips off and decapitates the driver, and that's Billy's father. And then the in time-honored fashion, the vehicle careens down the hill, blows up, and kills both occupants. I love the word careen because it's such a journalism cliche. And as a journalist, I think I remember in journalism school being told to eschew that one, or just to do your best to steer clear of that. But as a crime reporter, or a traffic reporter, someone is always careening into somebody, right? So what you have is what you think will turn out to be 14 years hence, or post-accident, what you think will have happened as well. This boy is left to his own devices, and maybe he's brought up in this terrible household, and he will turn out to be this killer. And given his name is Billy, well, we've already established the name Billy as a common one among horror antagonists, given, let's say, Silent Night, Deadly Night, and, you know, punish with that Billy. But put on the map, first off, in the seminal 1974 Canadian horror film Black Christmas. And Billy, I mean, that's probably the most famous iteration. And of course, you have variations thereof in for Billy in Gremlins, and I could go on and on. I mean, but it just seems so ubiquitous at the time. This character played by Jimmy McNichol, he's a basketball player, and he's got this alpha male kind of activity that he participates in. He's quite a baller and everything, but at the same time he brings this vulnerability. And interestingly, Bill Paxton, I think in a very, very early role, is one of his teammates and accuses Billy of brown nosing and kissing the coaches behind. Billy is actually being scouted by the University of Denver to play on and get a college scholarship and whatnot. So kind of an interesting dynamic there, not to mention the fact that Billy's coach, it turns out, is gay. So this sets in motion a very interesting plot device. And again, this is not your standard stock and slash. This is something that's a very unique beast in its own right. So what you have is the coach's lover, who is a TV repairman. He comes over to the Lynch household, and there's an altercation between the TV repairman and Cheryl, who is the aunt who is raising Billy. And in this altercation, the TV repairman is killed. Cheryl kills him with a knife. Now, she tries to get her story straight and insists that, you know, Billy, as the ostensible witness, that she was being sexually assaulted, and that would justify self-defense in her knifing of this contractor. However, the chief investigator, who's played by Bo Svenson, will have none of that. And he posits his own theory that this is a love triangle involving both the deceased, who is the basketball coach's lover, and also young Billy. So what would have happened is that maybe there was some jealousy sparked by the closening relationship, or budding relationship between the basketball coach and his young charge, that eventually blossomed into a romance, and then things got to a head, and then Billy ended up stabbing the victim. So that is what he posits, and this is something that he will not drop, because he is a dyed-in-the-wool homophobe. Butcher Baker, Nightmare Maker, really makes a lot of use of the F-bombs here. Like, he just, Bo Svenson, it's cringeworthy how many times he uses fag. And when you see a movie, let's say like Warriors, when one gang member is chiding another one, saying like, what are you, you're not really tough enough, what are you, some sort of faggot? And when you hear it in that context, I don't want to diminish it, saying it's not as bad, but it kind of isn't as bad, just because it's not used in such a derogatory way as it is here, because it's alpha male, two young bucks just being idiots. But here you have someone who should know better, and that's the police lieutenant. And he uses this term so often, and he will not let go. He's just like a rabid dog with this theory, and he's just chomping at the bit to just pursue this against, all odds, just to continue this harangue. And this is something that he's going to pursue. And our listeners will really know Bo Svenson as, the star of Snow Beast, but also Cracker Jack 3. But he's also in the original Inglourious Basterds. He's a favorite of Quentin Tarantino's and is the only, I think, actor to appear in both Inglourious Basterds. But he's a naturalized U.S. citizen, born in Sweden. He's a hulking figure and an ex-Marine. He's like 6'5", and he just cuts a great figure, and he's just a real jerk. And his character is really good, and I think they even make him an ex-Marine in this one too. So he just bullies and just charges forward with his theory. Meanwhile, the relationship between Billy and his aunt is one that's further explored here, and greatly explored, and insofar as she does not want him to leave and has this very protective. She doesn't want him to leave the nest. She doesn't want him to go to Colorado and pursue his athletic dreams. And her character is just absolutely great. This is Susan Terrell, who plays the aunt. And she's just absolutely dynamite as Cheryl, who's just very unhinged, who doesn't really countenance or take into effect any of Billy's wishes. And whenever the discussions of scholarships are brought up, she just dismisses them. And she even makes a bedroom for her nephew to I guess rent or something when he's going to start a life for himself in small town California, as opposed to just going and forging his own identity out in the world. So she just basically, you know, doesn't want to cut the apron strings, and she just keeps him very close and tight. This is the dynamic between the two of them is really, I mean, it really comes to a head when you see him passed out and she's actually licking his face. So they have all this, there's this incestuous, I mean, you wouldn't even want to call it subtext, because it's pretty, like, pretty blatant text, but you have this, the dynamic between the two of them is very ambiguous. And to make matters worse, what you also have is this nagging, persistent investigator, the constabulary, that the Bo Svenson character, the lieutenant, who is so hell-bent on his theory that he's pursuing it to, like, by any means necessary. And this includes also, he plays Detective Carlson, so this includes pursuing Billy, but also Billy's girlfriend, and asking them about how many times they do it, or in 70s, 80s parlance, how many times they make it, which is really creepy to ask of a 17-year-old. But he just keeps going and keeps pressing with it, and I guess this is to establish that Billy is actually gay, and that and that this is how things transpired with the murder. It turns out, and this is where we're going to venture into spoiler, what did we learn territory, but the aunt is really the chief antagonist here. And when I was thinking, as Mother's Day just passed, and there's a few of real genre standouts that really amplify the mama's boy dynamics, and obviously the first and foremost what everyone calls to mind would be Psycho, right, with Norman Bates, but for our purposes, too, you can't help but throw in the likes of Maniac, which has really strong dynamics there. And when you have the Frank Zito character, and he's just calling for his mama, and you have him just surrounded by mannequins, and there's tons of movies that play on this theme, but I think those are the two ones. I think this one, and the denouement reveals itself to so that when Billy, I guess, does a little bit of investigating, he does find out that he has a closer relationship with his aunt than previously determined. And that's just something that's really well drawn out as well. And this is a movie that takes its time getting going. And this is, again, not something that you would think of for the time. It calls to mind all some of the tropes and trappings you would see from the type of boom era slasher films. And it really doesn't have any of those. It's more meandering, it's more protracted, it's more deliberate in a way. And maybe some would say it's boring. And as an aside here, I find that criticism to be extremely tedious. I was thinking, I was on Instagram, and someone I was following just dismissively said that they found Suspiria boring. And I've always thought, like, you have to engage with art at least halfway, and you have to bring to the table at least something that in which to engage it. As like, being bored is already something that should be satisfied by the fact you're engaging in entertainment, so-called. So I find that a strange criticism. I mean, to be bored is like the paradoxical wish for the desire to have a desire to do something, and it just really irked me. Not so much that it was a time-honored classic in the pantheon of horror like Suspiria, but just the fact that something is boring, or worse, as I'll see something dismissed, it bored me. I find that extremely irritating. Like, I could say easily that Manos, The Hands of Fate, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had scenes of driving that were very boring, but neither movie was boring per se. Manos maybe had long stretches of inactivity that were maybe not the best developed, but I mean, my God, it's not like boring in the sense of someone showing you their, you know, vacation videos or something. There are certain things that are legitimately boring, or as the famously dour philosopher Schopenhauer once remarked, like, if pigeons flew around already roasted, we would die of boredom. But it's an aside. I don't know to what extent people will engage with this movie, but I think if they're fair, they'll give it a fair shake, because there's a lot going for it. I mean, you have, in one case, Cheryl, the aunt, the overly zealous and overly intrusive and hands-on aunt, walking in on her nephew and his girlfriend right in the throes of passion, and then calling her, his girlfriend, a slut and all this stuff. And there's a lot of just weird things going on, and a lot of voyeurism and just strangeness that goes on. And she at one point grabs a meat tenderizer and pummels the girlfriend over the head, and you assume that she's dead. And there's just so many weird little quirky scenes that put this a cut above other types of films. And I think that's in large part drawn out by the amazing performances. And I think, you know, Susan Terrell is just dynamite as the aunt. And some have say this is framed as a contemporary Oedipus, and which is funny. It just reminds me of high school. And some mythology class or something, they showed us this Oedipus film adaptation starring Christopher Plummer. And I want to say it also had Orson Welles in it, but I could be wrong. But yeah, the Freudian undertones, it's something that really this movie really brings out. And I think there's a lot going for this one. And I really didn't know what to make of it right off the bat. And I think, to this film's credit, and this is directed by William Asher, that it keeps you really guessing a lot of the way, and all the characters are resolutely interesting. And this one would have, I think, raised a lot of eyebrows at the time in the early 80s, but maybe shouldn't. And it deserves, you know, a very, very engaging look. And, you know, there's tons of just dynamite scenes. There's a fire poker that's used in one scene to great effect. There's a little tiny scene that speaks to Lieutenant Carlson's bigotry too, where he's interrogating a looks like a migrant worker, this you know, Mexican character, and he pulls out his gun. This is this giant, like a 57 Magnum almost looking gun, and he intimidates the little guy with it. And it just, his character is really well done. And although you'll cringe and wince at all the fags being dropped in here, it really does make this more emotionally charged and resonant, I think. And it turns out, as things progress and unfold, that we begin to learn more about who Billy's actual father was. And, you know, again, this is something that I think is something that's well worth your time. And critics have talked about, you know, how this engages the stereotype of the overbearing mom producing like an effete son and that. And I think it's kind of, I like the way that they play with the dynamic of Billy, because you don't get the sense right off the bat that he's immediately straight. So they play with it, and they play with your expectations a little bit, although you can probably infer that he was, although there are different takes on that one. So I thought this one was pretty dynamite. I mean, given the subject matter, you got to hand it to it that this is a really underseen film that deserves, I think, a little bit more attention than it does. So anyway, I think that's it for today. I'm going to keep this one short because I've got to get back to the business of journalism, speaking of journalism. But if you're a film fan, you'll notice a lot of the Hollywood Hills type locations and the LA surrounding area and the Elysian Park and some of the scenes. You can almost instantly tell when someone's just stepped out of Los Angeles and moved, or just to, you know, for the sake of convenience, to editing and you know, putting together a film. So anyway, I think it will be revisited with fresh eyes. I think at least it should be, and it might have been flat out wholesale dismissed at the time, but it really shouldn't be. I'm gonna give this one a solid 3 out of 5 stars, and it's, as a coming-of-age tale, very intriguing, very, very close, very solid, well-developed relationships with little silliness to bear brought in the proceedings, but that was par for the course back in the day. Definitely worth your time, and check it out. Continue to check out the Really Awful Movies podcast. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Thank you.